loving someone to hating someone.
Yep.
And then the hate becomes far stronger than the love ever was, right?
Yep.
I mean, there are a number of both private Telegram and private other types of dispatch websites where ex-husbands or ex-lover, men, ex-lovers, gather to collaborate about how to hack each other's ex-wives and how to help each other spy on each other's ex-wives and how to put a camera in a car or how to, you know, put an evil twin Wi-Fi set up in a house or... And unfortunately,
time out. What is evil twin Wi-Fi?
It won't happen to me because I'm either not important enough or I don't have enough money or no one knows who I am or those things I hear so often. And I'm always like, yeah, but do you have a social security number? I mean, do you have a bank account? Do you have a health insurance? Do you have a name? Is your name important to you?
And boy, that's a bad position to take, because the minute you think that, it's the minute it'll happen to you.
We had a case several years ago here in the Los Angeles area, a celebrity, very famous actress, and it was a guy who was a camera security expert who had installed thousands of cameras around people's houses, and in his basement they found him hooked up to something like 100 monitors, basically in real time, watching people in their homes, kids, families, people having sex, people arguing, and recording it all. We all have to do a bit of spring cleaning with our digital lives as well. And it's really, really important.
That's a good way to look at it. It really is.
The problem is this too, is that you said this before, is like, think before you act. AI replaces critical thinking in a way too. So we're kind of messed up a little bit.
People absolutely stop using their brain cells and say, oh, ChatGPT gave me the answer, so it must be correct. And then they get upset because it's, no, ChatGPT said this is the way to do it. And I'm like, ChatGPT is wrong.
Bad people know this. Good people generally don't understand this until there's a problem. And so what happens is the advantage right away is in the bad people's court.
Okay, tell us about that, because that's terrifying. The information shared in this podcast is intended for entertainment purposes only. It should not be considered as professional legal advice or a substitute for seeking professional legal advice. I'm Michelle Locke, and this is Love, Lust, Law. Today we're joined by Alan, who I absolutely love. He's fabulous. He's smart. He knows more about cybersecurity than anyone I've ever met. But he also does reputation management strategy and is advisor to Fortune 500 companies, venture capital firms, federal agencies, and tech startups around the world. His work sits at the intersection of technology, human behavior, digital manipulation, and online safety, making him uniquely positioned to talk about how social media and technology are reshaping modern relationships, from cyber warfare and reputation destruction to digital abuse, surveillance, and online deception. Alan has seen firsthand how technology can be both a tool for connection and a weapon for control. So let's dive in. Alan, thank you so much for coming. You are a vast resource of knowledge in this particular area in cybersecurity. And so I appreciate very much you taking the time out of your schedule to come on the podcast to really help educate our audience on really the modern era and modern technology and how it really is affecting modern relationships.
Well, thank you so much for having me. And I'm really excited to be on your podcast. I've been watching you with several episodes so far, and actually been really intrigued by the dialogue that you've been having with your guests, and I really appreciate the opportunity to be here.
I'll be honest, one of the ways we got connected was I used your company to help me through some difficult times probably about a year and a half ago, and your services provided and were invaluable and helped solve one of the issues I had. That being said, I have personal experience with your company, and it's been nothing but fantastic to handle and know that what you have going on is something that you all handle with such professionalism. But what is it, because I know what you all do, but what is it specifically for our audience that your company actually does?
You know, I think that's a great question. With regard to what we did for you, you know, you're also... And I know you talk about it sometimes in some of your episodes and stuff. You've had a very complicated scenario. And yep. it took a little bit of thinking to be like, well, here, what's going on here? So often, actually, before we even do anything, it's actually asking a lot of questions. It's like, so what's the situation? Like, what do you think you're dealing with? And what are you really dealing with? Okay. And then what we do is using a combination of forensic tools, computer tools, and human analysts combined. We're using AI at maybe 10 or 12 different levels. So we're doing everything from complete deep dive background research into people and companies and organizations that might be behind an IP address or might be behind a reputation attack or even a hack. But we're also getting into actually fixing the actual problems from a technical perspective. So if someone's in the middle of being hacked, we can both provide the guidance for them to stay safe as an organization or entity or person, family, and also continue to do their business while they're actually fixing the problem and mitigating the issue. So what we kind of have a specialty at is let's keep you in business while we're fixing things and do both at the same time. And basically what I saw a long time ago, which I believe is still very accurate, is that any type of reputation attack, whether it's through social media or someone creating a blog to take you down or worse, you get sued or, you know, the New York Times writes a front page article about you or whatever it is. As soon as that happens, there's like this whole chain reaction of basically affiliated platforms that suddenly are out there repurposing the same content that just was put out about you.
Right.
And you have no control over it. So what I realized was if you establish control as soon as possible. So some people that's actually creating a website in their own name, taking control of their domain name, taking control of their name, not letting other people use their name. In other cases, that may not be possible, or if it's a brand, they have to deal with the sort of long-term brand implications.
Right.
And so we started looking at, well, what could you actually do on a mechanical level to start to fix these things? So how do you take control of generative AI results in search? Or how do you take control of the vertical search results that we all think of as search? At the same time as doing while you're doing that, you're also both defending against attacks, but potentially even using that platform in an offensive way to reestablish your name or to establish the story or the narrative that you need. And so what I realized was that these two things, the cybersecurity and the reputation control, are almost the same. They're all ones and zeros. So all starts from a digital perspective. So when you look at it from that perspective, then you kind of have a more organic approach to how to fix some of these problems.
One of the things that I learned about when you were helping me is that with, and there's a different analysis, I think, from Android phones to Apple products, but you told me at one point that someone could literally send you a text message with a link, and if you click that link, it immediately installs spyware onto your phone. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, tell us about that, because that's terrifying.
And that exchange actually is even, unfortunately, even easier now. There's actually malware that can exist simply by hovering over something. So if you put your cursor over something, but you don't click, you could actually still get some types of malware. Now, a lot of times it's simply about opening the message or how the message was sent. Both with Android and Apple phones, what we see is that if someone's using the SMS capability, like just regular text phone, unfortunately, that has become so personal to so many people that they're instantly opening. They're not taking the steps that maybe you might take an email to be like, hey, is this spam? Or like, why is this email from a Nigerian prince claiming I own a trust fund in Switzerland? Like, well, but with the text message, it's so immediate. It's in your hand. It's in right in front of your face. And if it's coming from someone that you already have exhibited some level of trust with, in other words, that you've messaged back and forth a few times, you're very likely just to open that.
Yeah, you are. I mean, I'm getting ones right now, and this. So I think this is the current trend. It's the, you have a traffic citation, here's your court date,
yep,
and click this link to pay it. And I'm like, yep. I don't have a court date. And the problem is for lots of people, oh God, court, oh God, I'm in trouble. Only because I'm an attorney, I look at it and go, I never got a traffic ticket in Dallas. And I'm like, and who's this Judge John Smith? Let's go look him up and see if it's real. But that's the current one that I'm seeing right now.
That's a big one. We also see a lot of ones of like, you've won a travel award. You've won a 3-day vacation. Click here. You know, you've been selected because you were recently at this event. So now you've been selected for this other thing. And it's not just SMS. I mean, it could actually be as easy as with iPhones, for example, or Androids. If you have both Bluetooth and near field communication set on, okay, basically someone could come within a 15 to 20 foot proximity of you. And if your phone was on and not in a locked situation, it's very possible they could actually pass malware to you simply by being in proximity if you had those settings on.
Well, what settings do we need to turn off then? Can you tell us that?
Generally, you always want to keep your Bluetooth off unless you need to use it for your headset or whatever.
Interesting.
Location should never be on unless you need it for a map or something. And then to get more granular, near field communications, NFC, is actually, so that could be AirDrop, that could be a number of different, that's basically short field communication. There's no reason for any of us to be walking around with a phone that basically says, hey, I'm sending out a receiving signal. Send me something. So it's better to turn all that kind of stuff off.
Well, now I got to look at my phone.
Unless you need to use it. But I also think that, like, you know, I like to say that there's a digital common sense, okay? It's very similar to when you're standing at an ATM machine and you're pulling out money. And I know this is true for all of us anywhere in the world. You know, you look around, you want to make sure there's not like someone about to steal your money or about someone to like hold you up and get your ATM card or something. We all usually are looking around to make sure that there's not someone in that proximity, or if there is, maybe you don't go to that ATM machine, or you wait, or you go to the next one. In the digital world, it's a lot harder to notice those things, okay? But we all kind of get a sense of, you know, something feels a little off here. This isn't the way. I'm getting a message from my friend, but it's not the way he usually communicates. The word choice is wrong, or little things like that actually really mean a huge deal on the digital side. And so we do have a digital common sense, and it is really important to sort of pay attention to when you think there's something wrong, there probably already is.
Yeah, trust your gut.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, I mean, really, if your gut's telling you this is something's rotten in the state of Denmark, you need to listen to your gut.
And then I think the worst thing about what you're asking about, like, you know, how easy it is to transfer malware or something, you know, in situations where you have a former business partner, former spouse or a lover who's involved in your life and they know everything about you, and all of a sudden you go from, and I know you discuss this a lot in your work and on your podcast, you go from loving someone to hating someone.
Yep.
And then the hate like becomes far stronger than the love ever was, right?
Yep.
The hate. And what we see from that is that that causes people to behave in just, you know, completely ridiculous ways, right? There's this forced level of communication. So until you've fully cut something off and, you know, and it's done, at some point, the two people or two parties are communicating. And that actually leads to the ease of putting some kind of malware on someone's phone because you are in that communication mode. Even if you're super pissed at that person, they're sending me an email, I'm going to click on it.
Right.
So unfortunately, it's become widely known that that's kind of an easy way to do this. So there's this constant risk, I think. And then I think what we also see often with these situations where malware is being introduced, okay, or something like some sort of crime is occurring, it is often happening through social media now as well. So people are uploading links or they're using the direct messaging between people on social media to send things that are laden with malware. I can tell you that there used to be a bunch of Facebook messages that would sort of, we'd all get, and they were like a worm. And Facebook has gotten rid of most of those. But I mean, we still see that type of maybe not specifically targeted, but more widely, like, let's see who we can get, whose pocketbooks we can grab kind of approach. As you and I were talking before the podcast started, unfortunately, and I say this unfortunately, there are a number of both private Telegram and private other types of dispatch websites where ex-husbands or ex-lover, men, ex-lovers, gather to collaborate about how to hack each other's ex-wives and how to help each other spy on each other's ex-wives and how to put a camera in a car or how to, you know, put evil twin Wi-Fi set up in a house or, and unfortunately...
Time out. What is evil twin Wi-Fi?
I shouldn't laugh because it's actually really scary and really bad.
That's a completely new term for me.
An evil twin Wi-Fi is a setup where, let's say I know what your Wi-Fi settings are. The name of your account, and I've been to your house. All you have to do is turn over the router. I see the password.
Right, exactly. It's not hard to find.
It's not hard to find. So all you have to do is you create a duplicate Wi-Fi with the same exact settings. And the second Wi-Fi is a little stronger than the other one. So it forces the devices to connect to it first. And then what happens is they'll go back and forth between the two. And it basically allows for you to think you're using your own Wi-Fi setup. Meanwhile, you're actually being completely spied on.
So how do you know whether there's a twin Wi-Fi set up in your place? Twin Wi-Fi.
Like, that's something you literally would need to hunt down and figure it out.
Really?
Mm-hmm. And that's just one example, okay? There's tons of examples. I mean, one of the things that we have to do in my business is research hacks, okay? So, like, when we come across a hack or some situation, are we looking at a historical thing that's been done before and the sort of a path to remediate it? Or are we looking at some kind of custom thing that was just homebrewed in someone's basement?
Well, and that's the other problem is how many of these, and I'm sorry, I'm hot. It's like a hot flash. How many of these, like, are you seeing like homemade, built like ways to spy or cyber stalk?
Well, I was thinking about this actually before we started this morning. Just in the last 3 months alone, I think we've dealt with 10 clients in 4 states with basically this issue.
Really? And I'm guessing it's because the other side is technologically savvy, and so they're able to do it themselves?
Sometimes it's that, and sometimes it's, I believe, because they're able to so easily find the support they need or the tools they need to do it. And people willing to offer, hey, here's how to do it quietly so no one knows. And I spied on my ex-wife's BMW this way, and you can spy on your ex-wife's Chevy this way. And so, yeah, it's like a whole support network. We see this with the malware, with hacking crews. The idea of like a hacker...
Wait, time out. What are hacking crews?
What it sounds like, okay?
It's a group of people that are their sole job is to hack.
Yeah, 100%. And most of the hacks that you see on large corporations or enterprises or government agencies, almost all of them are coming from hacking cartels, hacking organizations, nation state hackers. The idea of sort of like the 15-year-old kid in the basement, you know, bringing down a nation. Maybe 30 years ago, that was sort of true, but nowadays it's much more organized. And so what happens is the malware deliveries as a business has support desks and they have help desks. And you can literally purchase malware on the dark web, okay? Go fill around, install it, and then be like, oh, I have a problem. It's not working the way it's supposed to work. It's not making the ATM machine spit out dollar bills. It's giving me an error. Well, the help desk that you just paid for with your malware will help you.
Here's our solution
for that problem. All of this is illegal, 100%. It's illegal at the federal level, state level, often at a city and county level. It's illegal internationally.
I guess my question is, there's just not enough, and I don't know how this works, are there not enough resources to stop the people like this that are doing it? Are they so sophisticated we can't figure out who they are?
We know who a lot of them are. Some of them we don't know because there's anonymizing tools and whatnot. The U.S. government has committed a tremendous amount of resources to protecting our cyber defenses.
Infrastructure, right.
Infrastructure. 10 years ago, 15 years ago, we really didn't even have a cyber command. We really didn't really have a CISA. We really didn't have the federal agencies dealing with this. Now we do. we're much, much, much more protected and are using the same tools that Russia or China or North Korea are using as well.
Okay.
But what does that mean for like the small business who's got 100 employees? Or what does that mean for even a large company with 50,000 employees, but they're not tapped into that federal government piece? They got to deal with their own problems. They got to deal with their own hacking. They got to deal with their own reputational issues. Okay, now what happens when you're the single ex-wife or ex-husband of in a relationship that was a power dynamic was lopsided to start with? Maybe it was money, maybe it was something else, or both. And that power dynamic continues to be lopsided after the divorce happens, and now the technology basically becomes an accelerator, essentially, for that power dynamic also to be leveraged.
It's almost a little scary. And one of the things we were talking about offline before we started recording was you were talking about when you go buy a computer, and it's basically an open device for hacking, right?
Yes. All phones, computers, watches, almost everything that we purchase as consumers are shipped to us in the default open state. So you, as a consumer or as a business owner, you literally have to spend hours going through each device, manually configuring the privacy settings and manually configuring security settings and turning off things that you don't need. Everything's turned on. And so the problem is that the criminals know this, and bad people know this. Good people generally don't understand this until there's a problem. And so what happens is the advantage right away is in the bad people's court because of that. So they know, like, and especially like, oh, go buy a new Android. Okay. Well, what happens when your attacker switches from an iPhone to an Android because they know that you just bought a new Android? So now you're back at the same, like, and then the other thing that we've also seen with that kind of same argument is cars, okay? For all of us, anyone who has a car that's newer than basically 2020 or 2021, there's embedded chips that are tracking our every single movement, every time you turn the steering wheel, every time you go over a bump, every time you change radio stations, every time you change radio stations, talk on the phone, drive, and turn the turn signal all at the same time. There's a computer sending that to 300 other companies out there purchasing little pieces of information along the way. So what we've seen and what I've heard a lot has happened now with both law enforcement and even in litigation situations is they don't have to wait for warrants anymore, because now they could just purchase this information from a company that actually has already aggregated all that information. And it's sliced and diced in a way that, like, I often think about this when I'm driving my car, and I do have a newer car, so I'm guilty of this. Okay, if I stop at a stoplight and I'm just waiting for cars to go by and I'm waiting, not only are the cameras on the street looking at me and getting my license plate, my location, okay?
Yep.
So that was probably 10 or 12 cameras at once just being at a traffic light. Plus, you got the cameras, the dash cams of other people. Plus, you got the cameras from all the automated cars, Waymo and everything else. So right away, forget any semblance of privacy, okay? Because just that alone, you're already, your image, your face, your license plate, your car, exactly. People know exactly where you are every second of the day. Now, when you add into that this information is being chopped up and sold to probably roughly 300 database companies at a time. So if you have a smart car, your smart car is making money every time you drive, but you're not making the money. Like, it's going back to the car manufacturers. And so the invasion of privacy that I believe represents is so huge. None of us can really comprehend it.
No, I'm sitting here almost speechless, which is unusual for me.
What it means, in my opinion, and this is just my opinion, is that whenever people talk about the idea of privacy in anywhere other than a cave, I don't think it's possible anymore.
Well, isn't that terrifying?
Yeah, and so you do have to take the steps to, like, how can you mitigate that? If you know that that's the case, like, what do you not do? Okay,
Well, and that is the question. Okay, so yeah, give us the steps. What do you got to do when you first get a new device or first get
a new device immediately before you try to connect it to Instagram and start looking at the next thing? Actually spend a couple hours and go through every single possible privacy setting, location setting, every single for apps. You have to do it for the phone. You have to do it for the folders. You have to make it's two-factor authentication. Turn off anything that's not being used. So if you're not using Bluetooth, turn off. If you're not using near field communications or near field payments, turn off. If you're not using AirDrop, turn off. Turn them on when you need them and then turn them off again later. Put two-factor authentication onto the device itself so that the minute you actually use the device, you actually have to log in. You can't just turn it on, okay?
Okay.
And also, but not just two-factor authentication on the device, ultimately, you need to extend that down into that wherever you're allowed to put two-factor authentication into a banking app or into insurance or healthcare or anything where, and if they're not requiring you to do that, you really got a question. Do you really want to be doing business with a company that is not up to the security standards that should be required in almost every state? So it's kind of a really big red flag. Like if you're suddenly not being asked to do two-factor authentication with your credit card, maybe you need to switch credit card companies.
Okay, interesting.
Because it means that their security probably overall is not as good. I think when it comes to new cars, the same thing actually has to happen. I had to teach myself. I had to be a geek and sit there and Google this. Like, what are the security functions inside my car and how do I find them? Okay. Then I had to tell it what my car was and I probably don't know all of them. I think I know some of them. So there are settings in cars too that you can utilize, but you have to actually be a geek and open the owner's manual and open that control panel and sit there and do it. Otherwise, your car is shipped to you, broadcasting everything that you do.
Wow.
Most people don't have the patience for that. We all know this, and this is one of the issues too that we face is that nobody reads the small print anymore, right? Michelle, you and I talked about this in terms of this. Nope. Like a lot of people that don't read the small print end up in Michelle's business in this capacity. And Alan, I'm sure you're hired because many people didn't read the small print as well.
Yes. Yes. And also not just the small print. And I think that's a really good point. Add to that, in my opinion, part of what we're seeing with all of these problems right now is the lack of attention span that almost everyone has now. And yeah. there've been some scientific studies that have shown that our attention span as a society, as people, has dramatically shrunk, you know, from what would have been well over 10 seconds, which is still a really small amount of time, to basically about 1.8, 1.7 seconds is roughly what you have in front of you before someone's phone dings or before something happens to take their attention elsewhere. So that 1.7 seconds, not enough time to get people to think about the security of their phones or the security of their device or watch.
Well, I also think it won't happen to me.
Yeah, well, that too.
And boy, that's a bad position to take because the minute you think that, it's a minute it'll happen to you.
Yes, and to add to that, I think that's an incredible point. To add to that, not only is it that part, but it won't happen to me because I'm either not important enough or I don't have enough money or no one knows who I am or those things I hear so often. And I'm always like, yeah, but do you have a social security number? I mean, yeah. Do you have a bank account? Do you have a health insurance? Do you have a name? Is your name important to you? Like all of those things. And so we are all vulnerable. Obviously, some people may be more vulnerable than others. And I think in these situations, Michelle, that you see with your clients often, I mean, you have this toxic mix of high emotion, of money, sex, you know, drugs, whatever
like
else
sex,
is going
drugs,
on.
And rock and roll as a party.
Yeah. And then you add, I'm going to hack you and I'm going to spy on you and I'm going to make it so your life is so miserable you can never, ever, ever do anything. And 5 years ago, that would have cost someone some money to do that, right? But now, what, $100 on the dark web and all of a sudden they're harassing you forever.
So are there, and because, you know, in my line, we get the tracking the cars. They put a tracker on the car because they want to know where they're going or not. And the funny thing is, when I have a tracker, in case of the tracker on the car, sometimes we may tell the clients to screw with the person who's tracking them and like go park. I know I've said this before. I'm like, go park at a strip club and leave your car there for a week.
Yes. I do think, yes, we give advice like that a lot.
Right, because it's like, they want to follow you.
The strip club one, but yeah, we do give advice like that.
Yeah, no, go give them the strip club. The strip club one is great for so many reasons, but yeah, I would do, I've said, I'm like, you know what?
If you know someone's spying on you, you can have a lot of fun with it, actually.
Correct.
Because we all have time for jokes and games here in this era.
Yeah, and then if you know someone's really maliciously trying to do something to you, you could actually make their life so confusing. I mean, one of the things I kind of joke about with people when they think that they're actually being listened to, like not just like followed, but where they think that their every word is being heard. Okay, find the worst music that you like literally cannot stand, okay? Blast it at 11 when you walk out of the house.
Yep.
You know, like, just like, if you know this is going on, like, have some fun with it and kind of, you know, but at the same time, obviously, there's a real serious side to it. And one of the things that we will do sometimes is actually set traps.
Yep.
I think, Michelle, as you know. And
I'm very familiar with the setting the trap. And let me tell you what, it works.
And especially in this digital age when you have this attention thing, okay, if you already got someone's attention about a specific subject, the algorithms will actually act for you. And it drives that attention even more so. So if they're already into something and then they think some, so you know, we've done things where if we know that someone's being followed or we know that something's happening, we will literally create fake events or we'll create fake situations to see if that other person shows up.
Yep.
And they do a lot of times.
And that's one of the ways to confirm you've been.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty damning when they show up at the strip club that you've parked at.
I'm going to add that to our repertoire.
It's a really good one.
I hadn't thought of it, so I forgive me for not thinking of that one.
No, well, you know what? I'm actually – normal people wouldn't think of that. let's just be real honest. But for me, like that's, you know, I do family law for a living. So clearly I'm not normal. Let's just start with that. But to me, it's like they want to follow you. They want to stalk you because they're trying to find out who they're sleeping with, who they're dating, because how dare they leave me type thing. Right. And so they do, they follow, they stalk, they want to keep track of all your whereabouts. And so let's have some fun with that. So I, you know, go to the strip club, park there for a while, and maybe go to like some like shady part of town if you feel safe and stay there for a little bit. But, you know, prove a point.
Yeah. I mean, and we'll actually go so far sometimes as to actually create a honeypot online where it'll either be part of an existing website or even a new pop-up website to even sometimes target one person.
Yep.
To see if we can get them to act and to show themselves.
Yep.
And it works. I mean, that's led to people going to jail or being arrested.
Being arrested and or quietly going away.
Going away. Yes.
I'm not gone, Michelle. I'm here. I'm still
Pardon?
Here.
Pardon? No, you're still here, Jake. Sorry. I've not been able to trap you yet with the honeypot. But sometimes just getting them to stop and go away is enough, right? Like – sometimes the criminal charges aren't what you want. Sometimes the criminal prosecution would not be appropriate given the certain circumstances, right? And everyone's circumstance is different. Everyone's circumstance is unique. And what works for some doesn't work for all, right? Like you've got to figure out how it is that you can address that issue and feel safe. And so in some circumstances, it's just them going away and knocking their shit off.
I agree. And I would add that the component of law enforcement, I mean, you kind of touched on this earlier. It is under-resourced partly, like there's not enough people, but it's also that there's not enough people in most jurisdictions who actually have the technical skills to understand these cases so that you could present it to them with all the emotion and anger or whatever, but they're going to look at you because their eyes just glazed over, like, because they're like,
oh my God, this person's, they're like, huh?
Yeah, this person's having a technical conversation with me. When I hear the word crime, But so this happens with a lot of law enforcement. It's not, and I'm not putting blame on anyone, or it's a training issue, it's a money issue, but that has also led to a situation where, you know, someone who might want that peace and quiet might only be able to get it through law enforcement interaction, but the law enforcement's like, what? Like, what are you talking about?
And it's not their fault, because it's not their fault. It is highly complex, right? Even, you know, people that are educated and have PhDs and doctorates and whatever else can look at this stuff and go, huh? Because that would be me, right? I technically have a doctorate, which is a whole other issue. But it's, you look at, like, I look at it and my eyes glaze over. I'm like, I just shut down because it's so above my pay grade. But so the general public or law enforcement.
Well, and the same thing exists with judges also. Yep. So what we've seen with a lot of cases, and especially I, as an expert witness, I'm coming in, or an expert consulting witness, sometimes it's behind the scenes where we're not necessarily testifying in court per se. Okay. Sometimes it's documentation back and forth, or often it's a judge wanting to call both lawyers and myself into a back room chambers for basically a technical discussion so they can understand what's going on in the case. Okay.
Yeah.
And that's happened more often recently in the last couple of years. I think it's good that judges are acknowledging, hey, there's like this whole conversation going on that we don't really understand. But it's a little bit terrifying. It's like, if you really need help, and then you're in a jurisdiction where they don't have a lot of cyber detectives, or they have none, okay? And then you also have a judges who have little to no understanding of this technical space. How do you deal with that? And I don't have the answer to that. I mean, that's a real question.
It's a real question. So I had a case within the last year where we sought a protective order and involved some online individuals. And it was it was the first case like it that I've tried that related to the cyber stalking, which is spreading out misinformation, using your followers to keep disseminating the information and basically stalking her online. And I remember having a discussion with my paralegal, because he's like, I don't think this meets the definition of stalking. And I think he's like, I don't think you're going to be able to prove it. And I said, no. I said, well, I said, I agree it's technical. I agree that it's a level of sophistication on stalking that I don't think is common or been explained to the judges well. This judge got it. And it was very, like, technical. It was very, here's what he's doing online. Here are some of his streams that he has said the following things about her. Like, and so once we explained it, and I think it's how we framed it to the judge, she granted a 10-year protective order, which was a big deal.
You know, I think you see this a lot as well. What we see with our clients with stalking, fortunately, and it's not just women who get stalked. There are also men who get stalked. I mean, obviously women you hear a lot more about, and I think there's a higher incidence of it, but there are men who do get stalked for various reasons. But the stalking is a form of something called stochastic terrorism. Stochastic terrorism.
Okay, I gotta look this up. Keep talking while I Google.
What stochastic terrorism is basically keeping people in a constant state of fear. And now it can be used at a nation state level. It's also something that is integrally to this modern stalking issue, where you don't know if it's the account themselves or the person themselves, or is it an AI agent, or is it, like, it creates this level of uncertainty constantly. And that really, really keeps people off and puts people into a very bad spot when they're the victim of this, because it's a 24-hour cycle. You don't always know where it's coming from, and it keeps you in this constant state of fear. The worst stalking case that we've seen recently that did not result in some kind of violence, okay, that's a whole different
thing. That's a whole other ballgame.
But we have a current client right now who had a sexual violence event happen maybe 25 years ago. 10 years went by, the attacker disappeared. Because of social media, the attacker reappeared in her life as a stalker. And then also became to the point where stalking her and also filing aggressive lawsuits against her to make her spend money. And constantly keep her in this state of And it's an ongoing situation right now in multiple states. And, you know, our client ended up partly seeking help from the California Safe at Home program, which is for victims of domestic of sexual violence. And it basically helps them protect their privacy and their.
Oh, wow. You
know, but it's not an end all be all. And I don't know how many other states actually have something like it. So in this case, this is something that happened so long ago. But yet, because of social media and because of search engines, the sort of attacker from the past showed up again. But didn't actually do any physical
thing. But stalker.
Is stalking. Yeah, regularly.
So, stochastic terrorism is defined, because I Googled it, as the use of mass media or political rhetoric to demonize a person or group which statistically incites random, unpredictable individuals to commit violent or terrorist acts against them. The speaker avoids direct instructions or legal incitement, maintains plausible deniability, while cultivating an atmosphere where violence becomes probable. That was 100% my case. 100% yes. My on the protective order I did. It's exactly what it was. Right. And so how it works, they say, is the phenomenon operates as an interactive process relying on three distinct elements. One's the originator, which is a public figure or influential voice repeatedly broadcast hostile, dehumanizing language targeting a specific group or individual. The amplifiers, mass media, social media algorithms, and online echo chambers spread and magnify the rhetoric to a massive audience. The receiver, an unstable or radicalized listener, interprets the continuous demonization as a call to action, eventually carrying out a violent attack. That is terrifying.
And when you add that to what I was saying earlier about the fact that these mostly men are able to find each other and collaborate with each other online about how to commit these crimes. And then you add in this level of, you know, that someone else's ex-spouse could come along and terrorize you, and they don't even have anything to do with your situation, but they're coming along and terrorizing you because they saw something on a website and they just want to be a guy and help out.
You know, Jake, you and I were talking about this actually last night about, because by the way, Jake and I talk all the time, and it's not always at 3 a.m. But
I have my Bluetooth off, Alan, just so you know, because I know you have a top 10 list of checklist stuff. I always keep my phone closed. I never use a public Wi-Fi. So I'm just mentioning that in terms of our communication. Michelle, I have to keep my signal open 24/7.
Do you have duct tape over your camera on your computer as well?
I don't even have a camera. I use a flip phone. I'm just kidding.
Well, so, okay, here's my question. Duct tape, or can you use, like, the covers they come with?
No, they could use the covers also. Okay. I was kidding about duct tape because it doesn't come off.
I have duct tape.
So I actually have two computers, and one I specifically broke the camera on.
Okay, so let's talk about that for a second. Because this really piques my curiosity, and holy crap. I mean, we could talk to you for 3 hours about this shit. But like, don't tell them how to access it, but how easy is it to access someone's camera and look into their life?
Unfortunately, it's all too easy. There's you know, earlier I mentioned like the evil twin Wi-Fi type setup. That's a more complicated setup where you're really truly spying on someone. But if you think about how Apple works for a second, and on all Apple devices, it allows you to monitor the information on a phone, also on a laptop, or, you know, that the mirror is mirroring the information, okay? What that means is that someone who has the password and the username could mirror that on their computer, and unless you're looking to see who's connected to my Apple account, you wouldn't know. Most people are never looking to see who's, you know. So in a domestic situation, often the former husband or lover or whatever will have that information.
Well, now I'm looking. I'm going to turn off my Bluetooth.
Michelle, you're going to go down a rabbit hole that you're not going to like, because anytime you download software, most likely it puts everything in an open position. You actually have to manually go through each setting and make sure that you don't have location access, you don't have camera access, you don't have audio access. The problem is we talk into our phones, we use Siri, we use all these devices that prompt these apps, and generally, like, directions is the same way. Like, I often say, hey, get me a whatever Siri. It goes right to it. How do you think that information catalogs? How do you think it gets access to it? And that's a real challenge, Alan, because...
Oh, my God.
How can you use it and then turn it off? And how many apps do we generally have?
Your average phone is probably shipped with 80 or 90 already without anything that you add.
And I'm just looking like I have, you know, we got all this shit on our.
Right. And so what I was saying earlier is you actually have to go through each app for the settings and control the microphone and control the camera settings. And how easy for someone to use a camera or a microphone partially depends on the settings on your devices. But if somebody is intentionally trying to do harm and inserts malware onto your device to do that, it is unfortunately far too easy for them to trigger the microphone and camera in any live situation without you knowing it.
How do you find out if you're, like, let's say, because one of the conversations you and I had is I went out and basically got all new devices. That was the, no, we're just going to start over from square one so that we don't have an issue. That's what we did. But
which is not always my advice. I mean, that was, right. In your case, that was very specific to what was going on at the time.
It was very specific what was going on at the time. And so I said, okay, I got new devices. But, like, how would you know if there's that kind of malware on your phone?
So, I mean, that's a really good question. So typically we would be using highly specialized forensic software that we would actually connect someone's phone or a laptop or computer or, you know, notebook, whatever, and actually use the forensic software to analyze it, looking at it from the most up-to-date, like, malware and virus regulations and rules and all the things that would be current up to date today, basically, but then looking in and actually digging into all the folders and parts of the devices that people don't even know exist, but that are constantly keeping information about all of us, we would normally be doing a very thorough investigation to prove that something's there. It's like one thing to say, well, my phone's acting funny or it's hot or it's weird, you know, but to prove it and take it to court, you need the forensics. There are some ways that you can tell certain devices are acting weird or not correctly. Overheating, especially with a new device, is one of the more common ways you can tell that something's wrong. Because these brand new devices are pretty well quality tested. So for them to have some kind of an issue like that, it's pretty rare. So if there's like an overheating, you're always using them, but it's always hot, there's probably some process running that's not, shouldn't be. There are actually mobile, like, anti-malware and antivirus programs you could put onto your phones. Depending on the type of phone you have, you might want to investigate that. But I think that also just constantly looking through your own app, like, what apps are you actually using on your phone? If there's 50 of them that you're not using, get rid of them. Why do you don't need them? But then go through the settings for each one. Turn off the microphone. Turn off the camera. And it is a little annoying. But I think, unfortunately, these companies ship these products to us, like we've all been saying, in this wide open state. And they do that on purpose.
Yeah, because they make money off of it.
Yeah, they make buku bucks off of all the little slice and dice advertising going on.
Okay, so here's my additional question, because I'm thinking about, like, my TV now, right? Like, my TV, I can say, hey, Alexa, and my TV turns on, and it'll go to the channel I want to go to. So, like, and I see your facial expression. For those of you that aren't watching it on YouTube, you probably need to go to YouTube to see Alan's face right now. And I just mentioned that because it was a look of, like, horror and disgust and, like, oh, no, my God, that is such an avenue of problems for us.
I'm just thinking you're a lawyer. And our advice to all lawyers is actually at their homes to not use any voice-controlled devices. Now, that sounds like, well, I need to do whatever. Obviously, a microphone going to a dictation thing is one thing, okay? But if you're constantly using Alexa, or you're constantly using Siri or Google Voice or whatever it is, and you're talking, that means that in order for these devices to hear you say, hey, Siri.
They're listening all the time.
Right. Now, as a lawyer, I'm sure you're having conversations at home that you probably would not want other people hearing.
Correct.
Right. So when you're talking to your television, who's protecting that information? There's no HIPAA, there's no privacy law, there's no security, there's nothing, there's no checkbox for it.
Damn it, now I have to go home and unplug my Alexas.
So that's one thing As a tech person, I probably have the least tech house you've ever seen. I have an older, I mean, it's a smart TV in the sense that it has a couple apps on it, but it doesn't have like the two-way television. It doesn't, I can't talk to it. It doesn't listen to me. I don't have a smart refrigerator. I don't have a smart, you know, stove or any of that. I don't connect my car to my house at all, ever. I don't, my car does not have my contacts or any kind of media from my phone ever. So I use the car as a communication device, but it's not storing any information about my phone.
So like for example, the cars now, the modern cars will either have CarPlay, like Apple Play, or I guess whatever the Android one is, I don't know because I have an Apple phone. But like, is that storing information in your car that when you're
all of it. The second you've connected your phone to your car, if you've checked the boxes where it's like get my contacts, get my, you allow it to do, it's basically fully functioning as your phone. And yeah, that car is definitely storing that information and most likely selling it.
Okay, so here's my, I'm gonna go down the rabbit hole and I'm gonna go home and I'm like, get all the technology out of the house. But like, for example, I have Ring cameras in my house for security issues. And I don't want to get rid of those because I have legit security concerns, right?
Yeah, for sure.
And so for me, those cameras are absolutely for my safety, but then it's also recording. So WTF, what do you do?
Right. I mean, well, in your situation, you need cameras. So right away, right. Like, let's start with that. There may be other, and we could talk about this offline, there are maybe other options that are just as good that maybe aren't like, also speak to you.
Right.
The thing about Ring that most people don't realize is that Amazon has signed a deal that basically allows law enforcement to tap into local Ring cameras without you really knowing that that's what's going on. So if your Ring is on your front door and it's highly likely in your neighborhood that maybe it's covertly sending information to Amazon or to
what about the ones inside your house? Because wouldn't that mean you would think it's invasion of privacy, but then people...
Well, they're differently, okay? So the ones that face the street are triggered by someone walking by or, you know, there's different... So, yeah, but yeah, you definitely have a privacy issue in your home. We had a case several years ago here in the Los Angeles area. A celebrity, very famous actress, actually had cameras installed in their house because it had a child with special needs. And so the cameras were both in the house and then outside. And one day they called me in a panic and asked me to come running to their house basically because their camera system was off, is what she said on the phone, okay? When I got to the house, and this is a client of ours, I thought she was talking about the external cameras, like the security camera. And then she says, no, it's actually the other camera system. And I'm like, what do you mean the other cameras? And it turned out that they had wired their whole house with cameras separate from the alarm system cameras.
Okay.
And that it had its own server that literally in the towel closet was the server for this internal system. And it had a little monitor showing all the different cameras in the house. And like six of them were blacked out or fizzed out. And two of them were still working.
Yikes.
And I was like, well, who put this in? Oh, we hired this company. They specialize in doing these internal cameras. And well, the long story short was after a couple months of dealing with it, we ended up giving the server to law enforcement. Because whoever was involved was seeing images of children in the house.
Wow.
When they eventually took the information from the server, we're able to go backtrack to the originating IP addresses for the camera service, okay? And this was back when IP addresses were sort of solid. So if someone had an IP address, most likely that was like their address or they're pretty close to it.
Not anymore.
Nowadays, that doesn't matter. But back then, this was pretty solid. And they ended up, law enforcement ended up going to a home out in the desert, like an hour outside of LA. And it was a guy who was a camera security expert who had installed thousands of cameras around people's houses. And in his basement, they found him hooked up to something like 100 monitors, basically in real time watching people in their homes, kids, families, people having sex, people arguing, and recording it all. And the guy's in jail. He's in jail forever, probably.
Can you imagine what would happen with the system?
And this was pre-AI. This was mostly pre-social media. So this guy was like this lone person pedophile, basically, in a basement.
Yeah, he was a peeping Tom.
But he had the access because he was the one who had put the cameras in. But nowadays, you kind of can have the same kind of thing without someone having to have that whole setup and without... So it's a whole different world. And it makes me very nervous when I hear about people who've connected their whole house and everything's connected and all they need to do is use a remote control and they can turn everything on and off. And great. Sounds amazing for like a dinner party and, you know, for whatever, showing off your car collection, whatever. But in real life, you know, what have you just created for yourself?
Well, this is interesting. In California... Love Google or terrified of Google. I guess take your pick. In California, security camera installers face severe prison sentences and sex offender registration if they misuse their access to spy on clients. Installers convicted of video voyeurism and stalking under California Penal Code Section 647J and Penal Code Section 646.9 typically receive sentences ranging from 1 to 25 years, depending on the number of victims and the severity of the invasion.
Now, I think some of those laws might have come about because of the case that I'm referring to, because this was a while ago. And I think that most states, including Texas, have similar laws. They may not be quite as stringent, but...
I'm going to have to look up Texas because I didn't even know.
Yeah, most states now have pretty strict laws against security person doing something like that or using cameras in that way or improperly installing them or illegal use of device, illegal use of people's data, things like that.
Yes, I'm pulling up just a case and I'm pulling up, you know, you just Google like cases that involve this. And there's one where a person in Cleveland, Ohio, was arrested, and this was in 2025. He had been terrorizing women for years as a video security systems installer and was accused of using his access to victims' home and businesses to spy on them. One of the victims said that she and coworkers started receiving disturbing calls and text messages from a stranger while they were at work bartending. He was convicted of stalking 7 women.
Wow. And that's probably the 7 that came forward, right? There's probably more who maybe law enforcement didn't have proof of or didn't even know about.
Wow.
And these are the cases that you're seeing in Google right now, Michelle. What about the ones that are like still moving through the process and haven't been deliberated yet and haven't, so there's no answers yet. And there's a lot, I think, if you kind of think about it that way, there's probably tens of thousands of cases across the country right now kind of working their way through the system that deal with various aspects of things like this.
So people are getting rid of Ring cameras due to mounting concerns over privacy, law enforcement overreach, and the rising cost of mandatory cloud subscriptions. So do you have a suggestion for our audience for people that want to, like, I need a level of security like I do?
Yeah, I mean, actually, SimpliSafe is a wonderful alternative to that. It also allows you to install both internal and external cameras. It has a way to turn it off and on through an app. Also calls the police if something happens. I use SimpliSafe, and I made the mistake once of triggering the alarm, and I did have law enforcement show up with their guns drawn at my door within a few minutes.
So, Jake, I'm sending you the link because we're going to put the link to SimpliSafe.
I don't get any money from them, so if they want to offer me something, I'm happy to take it. And I rarely kind of talk about specific companies because I think I tend to be kind of tech agnostic, and it's like my role is more about helping and not necessarily advocating for. I also think that Delete Me is also a wonderful tool. Delete Me allows you to basically get rid of most of your references online that you don't want about yourself or your family. Yep. It's not that expensive. And if it's not Delete Me, then there's certainly other ones like that. Cloaked and a couple others, but just the ability of hiding some of your information. I mean, you can't hide everything, but the more that we all can kind of keep away from the public eye, the better. And it's a little bit like sometimes spring cleaning, okay? When you do spring cleaning, you know, you're opening the windows, you're opening the doors, you're cleaning everything out, moving everything around. We all have to do a bit of spring cleaning with our digital lives as well. And it's really, really important.
That's a good way to look at it. It really is.
Thank you. I think it's really important to take every couple months, just take a few minutes and kind of assess, like, what's going on in my digital life? What am I doing? Am I exposed? Google yourself. How many people actually Google themselves?
I don't, because I don't want to see the results.
Even with Delete Me, is I've tried two ways. One, I did a manual search on myself and went through and did all the information gathering and removal to protect my reputation online manually. It took about 19 hours.
Yeah.
When I used Delete, 19 hours, because you have to go through each individual site, each information broker site, make the request, wait for them to get back to you. They have to verify. It's a whole process. Delete Me literally cut that time into a fraction. So I think that from that standpoint, we deal with that with a lot of stalking survivors, is that they come to you in a state of frenzy, right? They come to you in a state of panic, in a state of the world is caving in on me. You have to think like a bad actor and a profiler in this way for what you do.
This is what I do all. This is the way I do all the time. Yeah.
Yeah. Tell us about that process when you have to like literally think like a criminal and how that impacts and benefits your clients.
It's a little bit like playing chess.
Yeah.
Except that we're playing on multiple chess boards at once. And if you remember, like Star Wars had like the 4-level chess going on. It's a little bit like that. Okay. And, there's a lot of research that we're constantly doing, both myself and our team members and our partners, about what is the latest, most antagonistic type of threat going on, okay? I personally have 7 computers lying around that I've intentionally subjected to some type of malware or some type of something to then see how we can respond to it, okay? Like, so I will break something and fix it. I do that on my own dime so that we can then instruct our clients how to be safe or whatnot.
And, okay.
I know that all the people who work with us are also constantly doing sort of similar exercises as well. I read a lot. I have to read an awful lot of research done by our competitors, our colleagues, researchers in government or academia, because the cyber world is changing so fast. You know, bank robbery is like bank robbery, right? I mean, maybe they might change their approach and change how they deal with cameras, but they're still robbing a bank.
Still the basic, give me your money. Here's a gun, give me your money.
What we have is a shifting ground. And it's like, you know, it's almost like being on, 1 minute you're on water, and the next minute you're on sinking sand, and the next minute you're in wet mud, but the next minute you're on a glacier and it's freezing. And it's a lot like that. Part of it is experimentation, like as a geek, like, okay, I'm just going to break something and see what happens and try to fix it.
I remember my brother doing that as a kid. My brother fried more hard drives or motherboards as a kid because he's now he's a director at one of the companies in town, and he does the back end stuff. He's always done the back end stuff.
Yeah.
But he learned by trial and error, kind of like how you do.
But same thing with social media too. So I'm very controlled about my social media, but I am on it. I'm using it. I use Instagram. I use Twitter. I use LinkedIn, YouTube. It's in a very, very controlled manner. I am doing it to control both my own personal reputation and my company's reputation, as well as to maybe even help our clients sometimes without mentioning them or things like that. I've locked my personal Instagram account, but I have an open Instagram account for our company. Twitter, I'm active, have been active on for almost since it was created. X. And, you know, all of these things are both really valuable to all of us, and they're also really dangerous to all of us. So one of the things that I'm doing as a user on social media is I actually will go and put myself in the role of a bad person and go see those communities and go hear what they're talking about. And I don't pretend that I'm one of them. I'm a lurker, and I'm just watching, and I'm paying attention to what's going on and seeing these latest trends and seeing what's being talked about and how, and then from that also doing the same thing in sort of a cyber community realm where good people are usually talking about how to protect and defend against these things, the very same attacks that maybe I just read about or heard about on the offensive side. So there's a decent amount of engagement just on a daily basis with companies, governments, people who both are experiencing these problems, or where we can replicate it ourselves and then try to do it and see how we can fix it.
Yeah, I guess the best defense is to know offense. How they do it. I mean, it's the best defense. Yeah, I mean, so that's interesting. What was your career track to get you to cybersecurity? How'd you get to where you are? Because you clearly know a whole lot about it.
Partially accidental, partially situational.
Okay.
So the situational part was that I was given a computer at a young age when I was probably about 11, I think. And it was I'm going to really date myself here. So it was back when you had to like put floppy disks into the computer to actually make the computer work, right?
Now, here's my question. Was it the 5 1/4 or was it the 3 1/2?
It was definitely the 5 1/4 to start with, the flat ones.
And the younger listeners under 40 are going to have no idea what we're talking about.
Of course not. Of course not. And nor do they know that we used to use them as wall art as well. So,
yep.
But I, as an 11-year-old, I basically was like thinking to myself, well, there must be some kind of program in the computer that's reading these disks that's allowing it to work. And I kept trying to figure out what it was. So I basically took apart a computer to the point where my dad came home from work and saw it kind of in pieces on the floor and was not happy.
Yeah, I'm sure he's like, wait, because back then computers were inordinately expensive.
I managed to put it back together and I ended up adding, I was being like a geek and I ended up adding a little speaker that I'd purchased at Radio Shack. So thinking that if I solder that speaker into the circuit board, then I could make a stereo out of my computer, but that didn't work. It just created a lot of noise. So, but ultimately by kind of hacking around my own computer, basically I figured out there actually was some software on it and I taught myself how to use it simply by literally doing keystrokes until something worked.
Happened.
And then basically flash forward, as I was coming out of college, I was fortunate enough to be working in the United States Senate for Senator Harris Wofford at the time from Pennsylvania. And he was kind of like, what are you doing after you graduate? And I said, I thought I have a job with you, Senator, kind of being a young, cocky guy. And he said, that's great. You do if you want one, but I think that you should join a presidential campaign. And my response was, well, I don't know anyone. And he said, well, I do. And the next day I was on Bill Clinton's campaign.
When
he was running for president as governor from Arkansas.
His first campaign.
And what happened was I was assigned two counties in Pennsylvania as a sort of the field operator. We won both of them. And then I was invited to join the transition team in November of 1992. And I got hired in the White House January of 1993. Like the same day that he got inaugurated, I got my White House pass. And basically I was a young guy who I guess somehow someone figured out I knew something about computers. And a few weeks after being there, basically, I was told I was going to be put on a top secret task force, which was to put the first ever network computer system into the White House. So what we did was we took the old phone system that they'd run the Korean War on, literally, and replaced it with the first ever networked phone system in the White House. So we ended up using the same computer system that the New York Stock Exchange was using at the time to run the stock exchange. And so I was basically the young guy put on this task force whose responsibility it was to understand everything that was going on. Okay. I wasn't doing any coding, but I had to translate what was going on to all the federal agencies and let these people scream at me and yell at me about, oh, we're going to cause a nuclear war. We're going to cause a stock market meltdown. We're going to whatever. And I was the one who had to, like, at 23, go out and deal with all these federal agencies.
So you were this young whippersnapper that knew more than any of the older folks did on any of the stuff related to technology, which is kind of what we're dealing with now on social media. Like, my social media manager is in her mid-20s, right?
Yes.
Because she knows way more about it than I do at my age.
Yes. And I started my career with a whole I don't believe in technology. It's never going to work. All the negative kind of things that you hear. So I still hear the same things today. different situations, but there's always naysayers and always people who are afraid that the world's going to end because it's similar to the discussion you hear about AI now. AI is a tool that has both good and bad applications. Will it ruin our world? No. Is it going to cause changes? Yeah.
Yeah, it sure is. It's going to result in litigation and laws being created. And so basically, just
fast forward after many years, I worked in Washington, worked in Hollywood, and then I worked at Paramount Pictures for almost 5 years. As I left Paramount, I started my first internet company, which was like an auction widget. And I guess right around the time, early 2000s, when Facebook and LinkedIn and Instagram and Twitter and all these other things were really starting to kind of take the mind of people, right? It became obvious that we were looking at a systematic societal cybersecurity problem.
Okay.
To me, it was obvious.
Not to everyone else, but to you, who is in the know and understands it, was like, oh, we got a problem.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it was basically like, wow, there's all these things that are being connected and no one has any control or putting any control into how they're being connected. And then all of a sudden, you're also, at the same time that you're connecting all these things, you're also taking pictures from inside your house and inside your car and of your kids and your dog and your cat and your bird. And all of a sudden, the world sees this whole private life of you, right? And you have no control over what happens with that. We still see all that happening today. And so what I realized back then was, wow, we're really looking at this huge societal change. And so that's basically what got me to start DigiGenX.
The one thing that sparked me calling you and saying, hey, or texting you and saying, hey, you want to come on my podcast, was the email that your company sent out about the changes in Google. And what you indicated in that email was it's the biggest change in 25 years.
It's been kind of slowly coming along, but they made this big announcement last week. If you look at Google search, it's no longer like the vertical search bars, where things are listed in a vertical fashion.
Let me look.
What you see first now is the generative AI component of almost every search out there now.
Okay.
There are a couple things that's not happened yet, but mostly everything what you see now is this generative AI overview first, and then the kind of search listings below it. And so anybody who's spent time and effort to try to control their search engine presentation and how they look in both all these search engines, where their products list and where their descriptions are. Now, everyone, if they hadn't spent the last year getting ready for this, are now scrambling to refigure the whole thing out. What is SEO? What is generative AI SEO? Is this all combining? And so our email message to our clients in that you're referring to is essentially saying, everything that you think you know about search has been now upended by Google on purpose.
Why, if you know?
They, as a company, Google has put billions and billions of dollars into AI of all different types. We've actually been using AI in search much longer than the generative AI piece kind of showed up.
Right.
People didn't realize it. People just said, oh, I'm searching for, but it was actually the AI creating those algorithms, moving things around. So they've been experimenting with it for a long time. Google is one of the primary investing companies and drivers in the quantum computing space, in quantum AI, and also in generative AI. And so I think that this is an opportunity for them to maybe highlight some of the products that they have already invested so much money in. I mean, I'm clearly trying to say to all the rest of us, your listing for your little hardware store doesn't really matter anymore. What matters now is, what are people saying in the big picture about hammers?
That's an interesting perspective. And I think that, I tell this often to people too, is we're kind of paying the bill for all the information we've shared over the past three decades.
Definitely.
And the digital footprint and sort of things now that people talk about, they didn't talk about 5 or 10 years ago, reputational damage, right? things that ultimately will be used in AI to formulate opinions and conversations and business and legal matters, right? And so both of you are sort of on that line. How do you deal with keeping up with this? And Michelle and I joke about this. It's often like a whack-a-mole, right? You'll get these posts and then this one will come up, and then you'll get this site and this one will come up, and then you'll get this YouTube and this one will come up. How do you deal with that in a cyber world that we live in?
One thing that I've said for years about social media, and I believe continues to be true, and maybe even more so with the generative AI part, is too many people have a knee-jerk reaction to immediately reshare, repost, redo something about some piece of information. Now, did they take the time to verify that information? No.
Right.
Did they take the time to actually click on the link? Maybe not. They just saw the headline and they want to like get the 5 second burst in their brain from five people liking their thing on Facebook or whatever it is. So is that the necessary step? Or should you maybe have an intermediary step where you're kind of saying, before I look like a fool and embarrass myself, I'm going to actually check this out and see if this is true. Now, if you do that, you're sharing verified and valued information. If you're doing the opposite and you're like, oh, here's this headline, I'm just going to share it. What are you actually putting out there? You're sharing something that may or may not be true. You're showing that you may not actually care about what you're presenting to your audience or how you're presenting it to them. And I think it also more subtly kind of gets into like, well, why are you, what's the ego drive behind that? That's where those five clicks or likes actually make a difference in your life.
How many times has a celebrity liked a post or unfollowed and it becomes a news story? So in terms of tracking their digital footprint and their digital activity, all this stuff builds up things that basically go into AI, right? Chat into these things. And then ultimately, the problem is this too, is that you said this before, is like, think before you act. AI replaces critical thinking in a way too. So we're kind of messed up a little bit.
People absolutely stop using their brain cells and say, oh, ChatGPT gave me the answer, so it must be correct. I got to tell you all, I'm going to tell you right now, ChatGPT is wrong. Do not go to ChatGPT for medical advice. Do not go to ChatGPT for legal advice. And don't go to ChatGPT for therapeutic, like mental health advice. It is not correct. Not.
I think all three of those things, I 100% agree with you. And it's scary, Michelle, because a lot of the advice that is being given is not only wrong, but it's dangerous.
Right.
It's outright dangerous advice. And I mean, we have a client recently who did, to his credit, use these tools to do a full like SEO review of the website, okay? And then presented me with the results and asked me, is this correct? So I went through this report. I literally went through line by line. And what I was able to show is, about 50% of it's correct.
Right.
And about 50% of it's completely wrong.
Yep.
And not because of the way that the question was asked or not because of the way that the information was presented to it. It's because it literally has not, that's not what it's designed for, right?
Right.
It's designed for something else. And what people don't really understand about all this generative AI stuff, it's not a super intelligence. It's not some thing that's like gonna like become a Terminator and suddenly a robot walking down the street and shooting us, right? Maybe it's coming in a few years. But right now, what generative AI is literally information already being put into it, being regurgitated into a new way, in a way that the machine believes you want to read that information. That's what's really critical here, okay, is that we're being trained to think like robots, but we're being trained to think like robots and being told what to think, not only how to think.
And so what I tell people is AI, it is a tool. It is not the answer. It can be an effective tool. It can be. But to rely on it entirely is a mistake. I mean, I remember I had a client who actually ran his case through ChatGPT and gave me what ChatGPT generated should be my strategy for the case.
Oh, I get that at least once a week.
And I'm like, I appreciate you trying to help, but let me tell you a little bit about AI. AI has never been in front of this judge. I have. AI has also never, and ChatGPT in specific, has never had to argue in court with this judge. ChatGPT has never had to assess this judge's mood on particular arguments on a particular day. I said, so while that is a great informational place to start, that is not how I'm going to handle it in court, and here's why. And then they get upset because it's, no, ChatGPT says this is the way to do it. I'm like, ChatGPT is wrong.
Not only is it wrong, Michelle, but it's also like being presented in a way that it's not fact-checked. It's not like, you know what? Do your own research. Like, here's our bullet. Here's an out. It's presented as if it's gospel. It's presented as if this is the smartest thing ever. But really, you know, if you think about these artificial intelligence, the fact that I can, as a cybersecurity person, can get these things to spit out exact advice on how to hack something within a minute after it telling me, no, I can't provide that information to you. What you're asking seems like it might be illegal. Well, okay, I'll re-ask the question and all of a sudden I'm getting the answer. But also I think that it's somehow too many people are allowing this to replace critical thinking and yep. their own human thinking. And I think obviously that's what this industry wants. They want the attention span economy on this instead of Netflix or Amazon or whatever. What I'm not happy with as a consumer is all this like generative AI stuff being shoved into every kind of device and software. And I just don't need it. If I'm buying a book, I don't need an AI tool telling me, here's what 12 people said about the book. No, I already chose to buy the book. So can you just like, and I'm using that as an example, but I mean, and I'm kind of making fun of it, but it's also like, you turn on any of these devices now and it takes an extra 5 minutes to turn on your computer because the AI thing is trying to like get up to speed. I think that part of it is, yeah, it's an attention economy thing where obviously these companies are making so much money. But Michelle, you touched on it, like with these people who are using ChatGPT for therapy or not just but any of these, and then instead of actually talking to a human being who's trained and clinically alert to these subtle changes, you know, it's giving people bad advice. It's giving people dangerous advice. It's making people feel that they're safe in dangerous situations when really they are not safe. We work with a number of different like therapists and people, you know, who are often referring clients to us because of various things going on. And one of them actually did an experiment recently where they tried to pretend to be a teenager at risk. And instead of being told, go seek help, call a suicide hotline, you know, as soon as it became, I have thoughts of harming myself or I have thoughts of ending it, within two or three repetitions of answers, all of a sudden it's, you know, ending your life isn't the worst thing. I mean, if that's the step that you want to go, like, so instantly, instead of a human being saying, hey, can I help you? Like, whoa, like, no. Instead, it just transitioned from, oh, that's an interesting subject, to, yeah, you know, if that's something you're thinking of doing, you should do it. And that's terrifying. That is absolutely terrifying that there's like this like compassionate so-called voice out there that is the opposite of compassionate, and it is the opposite of helpful, but yet it's deceiving so many people. And I'm not saying, when I say it, it's not a single platform or a single type of generative AI. The notion that these tools can be used to help people in distress like this, yes, there's a point where it could provide the basic fundamental steps you need to take and certain things to get organized. But when it comes to like what you were talking about, the subtleties, the human interaction, the language, we're not there yet. And we're in a very, very dangerous point where you have risky teenagers, people who are suffering from being stalked or some sort of sexual violence, and they're seeking a false help. They're thinking they're getting real help from this, but really what they're getting is this false, I guess it's like a digital false prophet in a way, is what they're getting.
Well, I mean, I've seen an attorney online tell female clients that they should turn to ChatGPT for advice to help them get through their divorce. And I heard Why? That, and I was like, oh, that's the worst advice ever. I'm like, that's just No, that's not what you do, because it's going to give bad legal advice. And then the problem is when it gives the bad advice and they follow it, you're going to have consequences in court, right? Especially if you're talking about, and this is what I'm thinking, well, how do I find out if my husband's cheating on me? And ChatGPT gives you a whole bunch of things, some of which may be illegal in the particular state you live in, and you do.
That and also could also lead you to companies or people who are doing unethical things that seem like they're doing something that's allowed. I mean, we see this a lot in my business where because of cybersecurity reputation crossover, we do get approached by bad players who are seeking to basically put a positive patina onto their bad behavior.
Yeah.
Now, we always reject those types of clients, but that is something that we see more of now, where there are more of these sort of marginal players who are coming along saying, oh, you fix people's reputations, help us. And then we do some due diligence and they're up in money.
You're like, we're not helping your reputation. Sorry.
Right.
You know, there's a movie coming out that later this year based on To Catch a Predator. It's called Primetime, about Chris Hansen, you know, the origins of To Catch a Predator and creating that aura of, you know, this sort of honeypot for child predators and, you know, what their capability is in terms of their bad acting, what they've either done in the past or using this moment as a way to vilify and ultimately apprehend them, right? These child predators. And this was like 20 years ago. So this is a long time before any of the stuff we're talking about now. But when you get to the role of AI in all this and reputational harm and stalking and things like that, and how people can set up these apps to do this automatically, this is a real scary thought, right? Normally we like to have people like Michelle, you bring people to court. You don't bring chat rooms to court. You don't bring AI to court. How, Alan, have you had to deal with this on a legal level when you're working with law enforcement and when you're working with lawyers and really get to the bottom of, hey, my client's being stalked, but we don't know who's stalking this person because of all the shields and all the protections that these softwares have?
So, well, I mean, first off, before we ever take any client to any sort of law enforcement scenario, we've already gone through a very heavy forensic examination. And the only way we would ever work with a client to go to law enforcement is when we can prove it.
Yeah.
So one of the things that ChatGPT or Gemini or any of these gives a false sense of is, you know, that not only do you have an answer, okay, and that your answer is correct. And Michelle, as you said, it also could be illegal how it was obtained. But really, the verification on the forensic side that's required to prove a fact versus I know what's happening, but I can't quite prove it. But the forensic side proving it, it's actually a really big step. So that's a significant leap.
Yeah.
And so for our clients, we do not recommend ever talking to law enforcement until you already have your ducks in a row. You have enough forensic evidence that there is a case, because otherwise they're going to just be like blow you off because it's a technical conversation going over their head. You're using terms they don't understand. And I mean, unless there's blood on the floor, they're not going to get it. So,
and on these complex cases that involve really a higher level of expertise and knowledge to prove the case, you really need to make it easy for law enforcement and give them the package with the evidence. It's like, here's this nice package with all the evidence you need. Here's how we got the evidence. Here's where it's at. And that way it makes their jobs easier. Because if you make their jobs easier, they're much more likely to help you. Because if they don't understand it and they can't figure out how to investigate it, well, then it's not going to go anywhere.
100%. In fact, I mean, we've seen so much of that we're actually spinning out a product from my company, Digijax, it's a self-driven victim check sheet. And it does is it not only walks you through the process of what you need for your specific type of case, but actually helps you upload the information and put it together in a way that you could then take it to a lawyer or take it to a law enforcement. And that's come after years and years and years of seeing people at all levels, large companies, individuals, really struggle to get to that point of, okay, do you have actionable evidence here?
Yep.
Is this an actionable threat against you? Or is it like someone who's an annoyance and bothering you, but hasn't risen to that actionable threat level yet?
Right. Or it's just a pain in the ass, but it's exactly. Not illegal. Right? Like you can be a pain in the ass to someone and you can't do anything legal about it. Like I tell clients, you can't stop someone from being an asshole who's an asshole.
No.
You can't. Sorry.
And technology just makes them become even more of an asshole. So
that's technology has given them the tool to make it worse. By the way, the movie's name is WALL-E.
Oh, WALL-E.
Oh, WALL-E. Sorry.
I don't know why I blanked on that, but that was the movie.
Fantastic movie.
Right, but it's a fantastic movie that talks about like what happens and where we're heading if we stop using our critical thinking.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I actually, it's funny. People will make fun of me when I walk into meetings and I walk in carrying a pen and a notebook.
Yep.
And no computer. Often it's like the reaction is sort of like, wait, you're like the high tech, you're the cybersecurity person. Why? Where's your technology? And it's like, well, the first thing is, let me ask you some questions. and I've learned that by writing, just that act of it, I'm remembering things much more clearly than I do if I try to take notes on a computer.
Yep.
It allows me to see people's interactions while I'm dealing with them as opposed to staring at a screen and typing. And so you can often, in our business, Michelle, I'm sure you deal with this a lot as well. Even after a client has paid in a retainer and is working with you, that doesn't mean that you're right away getting the truth. Oftentimes it takes a long time.
Wait, what? Clients don't tell you the truth? No.
Yeah. So often it takes a long time of them trusting you to get to a point where they finally open up.
Yeah, I love being in court and there's something that comes out on the witness stand that's the first time I've heard of it. And I'm like, well, that would have been nice to know before today.
Yeah. So the one advantage I have over you is that we are often in people's computers and in people's phones. So we do see what's going on and which often creates a bit of a kind of hilarious, dramatic moment.
Well, it's like, are you sure that's the story you want to stick with
exactly.
when you're telling me?
Exactly.
Are you like, sure? Like,
you just gave me access to your back end of your computer and yet, but yet here you are saying this. So.
Yeah. I'm like, I'm pretty sure you want to change that story.
Definitely.
Alan, we're going to have you back at some point because there's just so much to discuss and there's one, not enough time today and we could talk for hours.
Thank you. If we ever do it again, I would love to do like some crazy wild client stories.
Okay.
Oh, well, yes.
I would absolutely love to do that. So that's actually, I'm going to have Gabby reach out to you and we'll get you back on the books. Yeah.
Like at 1 o'clock today, if you're available. I'm just kidding.
Yeah, right. I don't. I have to go do legal work now because I've got some cases blowing up. But where can our audience find you and your wonderful company?
Thank you. Thank you so much for the opportunity to be here today. I really, really enjoyed this dialogue. And I think that you're really doing some really important work, Michelle, and having this podcast and opening this discussion to people about these issues that are so important. So our website is digijax.com. It's digijax.com. Same thing for Instagram is Digijax. And then on LinkedIn, it's just my name. So if someone wanted to look me up, it's Alan W. Silverberg. And all three ways will respond or communicate.
And I will tell you, like I said, I've personally used you all. I've referred Thank clients you. To you. I think the service you provide is invaluable to those that need the type of help that your company provides.
Thank
and
you.
So it has been a great pleasure having you on. We will have you back because I don't think this conversation is over. I think it's just starting, and I think it is valuable information that our audience needs and quite frankly, everyone needs to understand. So thank you for joining me on today's episode of Love, Lust, Law. If you want to reach out to find out more about what's going on with me, you can. You can follow me across all social media platforms at Attorney Michelle Locke. Just remember, Michelle is with one L and you can thank my mother, Margot, with no T for that. Have a great one.